you know, wait 2 weeks before we had our had noon on the moon. But they were protected. They had the white spacesuits on. Remember the white spacesuits? So that would reflect like 90% of the radiational heat from the sun and from the ground. It would reflect off the ground, and but the suits reflected that heat away. And the other form of heat contact would actually be from the soil, from the regolith when we drop it. Well, regolith is this like powder type of material, and it's actually almost like an insulator. So even so, that was getting hot. It wasn't getting that hot. So that's why they were able to pick up, you know, big rocks and things like that. Because their gloves and shoes had enough insulation to protect them. So would they have survived directly, you know, noon at on the moon? I think maybe they would have. Back to you, Dick.
That's very doubtful, Paul. At high noon, the surface of the moon goes to numbers like 150 degrees centigrade, plus or minus 5 or 10 degrees. That's way beyond boiling water temperature. We're talking about 150 centigrade. I don't know the exact number, but it's probably close to 300 Fahrenheit. That's one hell of an oven. That's the surface temperature. And no matter how white your suit is, that's an oven. And you're standing on an oven when you're standing on that regolith. I don't think there's any way you can design a reasonable spacesuit that can tolerate that temperature without cooking that astronaut. And at nighttime, it goes down to numbers like minus 150 degrees centigrade. You couldn't create enough watts of power to keep that astronaut warm in that environment. So high noon and midnight on the moon are extreme in a lot of ways. All of that black lunar dust that got on their suits, that when they got back into the lunar lunar excursion module, as it used to be called, when they pressurized it and opened up the spacesuit, it smelled like burnt something or other. I forget what it smells like. And all that black dust on their suit was drastically changing its reflectivity. I bet you they were getting warmer as they got dirtier out there. I wonder if they, let me drop it. I wonder if they had a clothes brush with them so they could brush off that black dust. And one of the things that was not included in any of the explanations is that I think in the later missions, like Apollo 16 and 17, I think they were on the lunar surface for 3 days. Guarantee those astronauts were not sitting in that suit continuously for 3 days. They had to climb out of that suit periodically and clean themselves up and climb back in again. So those details were never made public that I know of. You can't put an astronaut with a big diaper on inside of a spacesuit for 3 days on the lunar surface. A diaper rash would be giving him ridiculous grief. So and there was no chair, to my knowledge, inside the lunar module. But at 1/6 Earth gravity, that's not bad to stand up in 1/6 Earth gravity. And I'm guessing there was barely enough room inside to climb out of the suit, do a cleanup job, and climb back into it again, and reestablish all of the consumables that are in the backpack. Did they ever give us any description of what was done when the astronauts were on the lunar surface for 3 days, what they were doing to reestablish the backpack and clean themselves up each night? I don't think they ever gave us any of those details, Paul. WS2N, K2IW in the TechNet.
RYY.
Paul first, and then we'll go over to Joe. Go ahead, Paul.
They had room to take the suits off, especially in the later missions, the J missions. I think that was, they started with 14, 15, yeah, I think with 14. They called them the J missions. They were a little bit roomier inside. They made room. They set up a hammock. One guy would sleep on a hammock. The other guy was more or less on top of the, another guy was like on the floor. But you had room to put your suit off in the later missions. And yes, for three, four days, you know, at least three EVAs, they come back filthy and everything. They tried to knock it off as much dirt or regolith as they could before they got back in. It was doable. I heard the other station, did you want to let him go?
Yeah, wait for the beeps and you got it, Joe.
Okay. Here's a question for you. Either one of you guys can answer this one. Has there ever been an incident documented where an astronaut has sneezed inside a spacesuit? And if so, what happened?
You've got a ball.
Yeah, they can do it, you know. They're not right on top of that glass. And, you know, and there's other things. They have water. They're able to drink. There's a way to grab that with their mouth. They even had some kind of candy bars type of thing that was suspended in it that they could bite on. You know, they were out there for 8 hours a day on some of the long EVAs. But I know they have the capability of sneezing. I have read that. Whether I never read that anybody actually did that, though. Back to you, Dick.
I am guessing that the astronauts had some training as to how to muffle their sneeze, even though you know you're going to sneeze. If you put a lot of effort into it, you can muffle that sneeze so that you're not spraying a whole lot of stuff out of your mouth and nose onto that faceplate. I'll bet you they had training on how to do that. What do you think, Paul?
Oh, I'm sure they do. It's just like your fighter pilots. And, you know, you got the same kind of thing, you know. They're up at, you know, 40,000 feet. You got the U-2 pilots. They were up, what, 75,000 feet or something. These guys were essentially in space. Guys that jumped out of the balloon. They were in spaces as well. They had probably plenty of practice before they ever got into a Redstone or an Atlas rocket. Back.
I'll run by again, Paul, the mission you described quite a bit earlier, which was a spacecraft that went to a comet. And I think it went in orbit around the comet. I wonder how close it got to the comet. I think you said that one of them almost or really did land on the surface of the comet briefly. And during the time it was going around the comet, while the comet was going nearer the sun, that a very large boulder on the comet moved. And I'll bet you they also have some beautiful photography of outgassing of the comet. So give me a few more words on that mission. How long ago was that? How close did it come to the comet? How long was it in orbit around it? And did it stay in orbit around the comet? How did that mission end? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, you'll remember when I talk about Rosetta mission. Rosetta mission launched in 2004, I believe. It took probably 10 years to get out there. You know, it had to go past the orbit of Jupiter to do this. Had very large solar panels on there. That was the first of the missions with really big solar panels. They didn't have the RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator, so it wasn't nuclear powered. So they got out to Comet 67T, with two long names of the people that discovered that comet, which I'm not going to try to pronounce. And 67P went into orbit around it probably a year or so ago already now, probably 2 years, 2015, I think. Maybe the end of 2014. I'll have to look. Time's getting by. Then they had Philippe, it was a boxy looking lander that separated from Rosetta. After Rosetta was in orbit around this comet that looked like a a weight, you know, like an exercise weight, you know, like if you were to grab one of those things, or a big dog bone, almost like two comets that were linked together. And it had the lander, and it lander separated. It went down to the comet, landed, sending all kinds of information back in the beginning. Because it had 50 hours of battery power. But then, you know, as it landed, it bounced. They know it bounced. It wound up in a dark spot. It took them, I don't know, 6 months or so to maybe 8 months to even locate where this thing was. So it became actually useless. But the early information, they did get quite a bit of technical information back from the lander. It went around, you know, the comet itself went around the sun with Rosetta in orbit around this thing. And then it started going back out toward Jupiter again, to, you know, past the Jupiter orbit. So that's where it is today, you know, it's here. Mission control at Darmstadt, Germany, lowered the orbit until eventually it touched the comet, and that's where it stayed. No more signal back either.
Yeah, it's coming back to me now. The lander had some kind of a spike that was supposed to dig into the ground and anchor itself. The spike didn't. It bounced. It went into a notch between the two dumbbell sides of this comet. It went into a dark spot. And did the lander ever get some sunlight on it? Did it ever come back to life at all, Paul, not even briefly?
Yeah, they got some kind of a quick signal from it, you know, sent the signal back to Rosetta when the sun just started hitting it. But it never really sent any useful information after that. They did all kinds of close photography. They brought the Rosetta in closer and closer. And at one point they were able to photograph it, and they saw it, the way the sun was hitting it. They now know exactly where that lander is. So I guess 100 years from now, when they send another spacecraft out to the comet, they'll know exactly where both of them are. And highly successful mission by the European Space Agency. I remember when it was launched, and it was launched on that same rocket that the James Webb Space Telescope will be launched on. The Ariane 5 launch vehicle down from French Guiana. By the way, they have all kinds of problems right now. They're supposed to launch two satellites and one to geosynchronous orbit. Let me drop it. And that was a couple of weeks ago. There's all kinds of labor problems, kind of movement against ESA and the French. Everything's on hold down there. Backing up a couple of the other future flights already that they have planned. You know, they launched three types of rockets out of French Guiana. They launched the Ariane 5, that's their big heavy lift vehicle. They launched Soyuz rockets, which they get from the Russians, and they rebuild the Soyuz to their specifications. They have a Russian crew on that's stationed there to help them out. But it's really a European Space Agency launch vehicle. And they call it Soyuz, you know. And, and then one other one is the Vega. That's the light, smaller rocket that's launched, built by Italy. It also launches out of that. Well, there's nothing that's going to go off until this labor dispute is taken care of. So everything's shut down in French Guiana. Back to you, Dave.
The labor dispute in French Guiana, is that people going on strike because they want more money? Is it politics? Is it money? Is it labor union? How long ago did this begin? And how long is it predicted to last? And Who's complaining about what there, Paul? Over to you, K2RIW.
I've been looking, you know, searching at different websites, European websites, and all, you don't know what you're bringing up. You know, I could be bringing up the Enquirer version of the French, you know, French media. I don't know what I'm bringing up, but one website seemed pretty reliable, and they were talking about deplorable conditions. What does that mean? Where they're staying? Are there safety problems? I don't know what that means. Are there really labor problems? Another website said that there's problems within the country itself. For instance, a lot of flights into the cap. They have a capital over there. I'm going to see. I forgot the name of that one. Right near Kourou. And flights from France are being canceled, and I don't know what's going on, so, we'll have to find out as time goes on, but, I saw pictures of big trucks blocking the roads, people can't get through. I don't know, it's actually a wealthier part of that part of the country, so I'm not sure what's going on. Everybody that's there, I don't think we're all poor, you know, these are, technical workers that are working at this place, so maybe it's problems within the country itself. We'll have to find out. Let me drop it.
I'll call the staff at the location. Is that staff 20 people, 200 people? What's your guess as to what is the staff that maintains that spaceport?
It's got to be thousands of people. I don't know. It's a You've got three launch complexes that are active, all three. They're bringing in flying satellites from different parts of the world that have to be over there. You've got two large solid booster rockets that have to be attached to the Ariane 5 rocket. It's a massive, operation. You've got their version of the Space Wing 45, which is our group that has to check all the boats and make sure everything's clear and no traffic downrange from these flights. All kinds of people staying all over, everywhere over there. I don't know. I have no idea the population of the spaceport itself, but it's got to be bigger than a couple of hundred back here.
Is there the equivalent of a large vertical assembly building? How do they put these great big spacecraft together, Paul? I'm having trouble believing that they just do that out in the weather with nothing but a launch umbilical tower nearby. That's question number one. And question number two, does French Guiana ever get any hurricanes? I bet you that can give them a lot of grief. Over to you, Paul.
No, they're not too far from, like Aruba and all that. I think Aruba got hit with one hurricane in the last 100 years or something. Great place to go on holiday, any of those places. So, no, I don't think they have problems with hurricanes. I've never heard of one hit. I never hear of a storm. You'll hear of a weather delay. They have, just like Florida, they have constraints that they have to deal with. The upper winds are too high, or they have a rainy day, I guess. But most of the flights always go off on time from French Guiana. They're really pretty good. When you listen to the flights, it's interesting. They all talk French. the French countdown and everything is really cool. And then they have a translator back.
That launch site that's in very close to Halifax, I guess it's Nova Scotia, on the eastern end of Nova Scotia. Alcatantara, something like that, Brazil.
I think it's the name of the place. And I think you said Cyclone 4 is going to be launched there. I missed some of that. Give me some more words on that, Paul. Is it a fully operational launch site there being established, or has it been established for a while and launches have taken place from there? And what's your guess as to how many miles is it from Halifax? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, I don't think it was too far, you know, northeast of Halifax, but it's Canso area, the Canso area, they call it Canso Hazel, H-A-Z-E-L, Hill area. So it's definitely, you know, closest thing there is the old buildings that they used for the undersea telegraph. You know, 100 years ago. You know, the Cyclone 4 is going to be launched. I guess they're going to start building the complex now. They hope to get it ready within a couple of years. Cyclone 4 is a rocket built by Ukraine. And they got their problems in their part of the world. And they were hoping Brazil was going to do it. Last 10 years or so, they've been trying to make a deal with them. They have all kinds of financial problems. They tried to launch a couple of orbital flights down there. Not with Cyclone 4, but, you know, with something else. It didn't work out. They never made it to orbit in Brazil. They tried. Maybe someday down the road they'll rebuild and be able to do that. They blew up their launch pad and... So that's out. So now Ukraine is making an arrangement with Canada to fly out of there with Cyclone 4. Back here.
You also mentioned that Camden, Georgia is in the talking phase, I guess, of building a launch complex. For that to be viable, I am guessing that Camden, Georgia must be on the Atlantic coast. You want to launch over water. If you launch over a habitable area of land and any of your hardware has a failure during launch, you end up putting space hardware into people's backyard, and that can make them angry. So how far downrange are they on the Camden, Georgia launch complex? And is there a guess as to when that might become operational? And that's a fair number of miles north of Cape Canaveral, Cape Kennedy, which means certain inclination of orbits will be appropriate, but certain other inclination of orbits might not be so desirable because you'd like to be as close to the equator as possible. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
K2UPS. Yeah, I know the inclination is between 30 and 60. And I can give you information, but I don't want to hold up Rich, mobile back user.
Okay, so inclination of launches between 30 and 60 at Camden. We'll come back to you on this one, Paul. KTUPS, hey Rich, where are you? And what would you like to add to all of the above? Haven't heard from you in all these hours of the TechNet yet so far. I was looking at my check-in list and you weren't there yet, so... thank goodness you finally signed it. You got it, Rich. K2RIW.
Yeah, good evening, Rich, and the rest of the net. K2UPS Mobile, Pennsylvania, near a little bit east of Somerset, Pennsylvania, on the way back to New York. But I've been listening to the whole net, and I actually checked Google, checked Wikipedia, and the number of employees at the French east of launch complex, and I'm not sure what year the stats is from, but they said direct employees was 1,525, indirect employees 7,500.
Take that, Paul. That's a lot of people. And if these are people with a union of some kind, they could really hold up the works. In French Guyana, my guess is they've got some very hot, humid weather there. So unless you've got some well-constructed, air-conditioned housing, you
could end up with a lot of unhappy people in the summertime. And up that area of the planet, I think you've got 11.5 months of summer. How do you call KQLIW?
Yeah, that's summer all the time. We're not very close to the equator. What's the word? Recuse. I'll have to recuse myself from the topic if it's involved with the union, because I'm probably one of the most pro-union people going, so that's going to leave me out. I don't care. They have a lot of satellite. Camden, Georgia. If you bring that site up, you know, they've been trying to do this for decades, and they finally got passed the House. I guess they have a Senate they probably have to pass, I'm assuming. So maybe it's not written in stone yet, but they have a logo, you know, for the Georgia Camden spaceport. And it looks like a map of Georgia, and it shows you roughly where it would be on the Georgia coast, the southeast coast. So it's a rural area. Nobody living over there. It's been used before as a test firing for a solid booster rocket back in the 1960s by Morton Thiokol. Morton Thiokol is the one that built these big solid booster rockets for the space shuttle system. And they built those out in Utah. But before they went to Utah, they tested a similar type of thing. 3 million pounds of thrust, some massive thing. They put it in a stand somewhere, and they lit it off. But ever since then, Georgia, back in the 1960s, they've been thinking about this spot for future space flight. So we'll have to see. Another launch.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You know, either government or private, or probably both. But should be interesting. Now, more Thiokol evolved over time. Let me drop it. And became ATK. And now ATK is merged with Orbital. Orbital was the contract that built the Cygnus spacecraft and the Antares rocket. And Antares and Cygnus now are linked to Wallops Island, Virginia, and that's how they launch out of there. Now Cygnus is also being launched by the Atlas V rocket, and that should come up next week. So they have some kind of, I think, a hydraulic line problem or something, so that's been delayed, but that'll be another flight coming up very shortly. So, Rich says roughly probably 7,000-8,000 people at least in the coast down in French Guiana. Yeah, I knew it had quite a bit. I've seen many, many pictures of that. It looks like people all over when these rockets are being built. Back to you, Dick.
Now, tell me what is in Georgia now that makes them interested in space. Are there space vendors in Georgia? Is there a Lockheed Martin? Is there a Morton Thiokol? What is in Georgia making them suddenly interested in space, and where they want a local space port up all? WS2M, K2LAW?
Well, like you said earlier, with the moonshot and everything, there were 400,000 people around the country, and every area had their place, for that flight. And they still have that today to some degree. And I think they said there's like 500 different small companies throughout Georgia that are involved. You know, we have Monmouth Island still, and even Manhattan is some company that makes the lenses or the cameras or something for the Mars rovers and all out throughout the whole country. So I guess they have some kind of infrastructure down there. They like the idea that they have the big, they have access to water. They can bring in barges. They have access to, they have some big roads, leading past 95, going, to west, you know, just like a lot of things are shipped into Florida, it could easily be shipped into Georgia. So, you know, they believe they have that infrastructure ready to go back.
Okay, so I haven't heard much about Georgia being a state with a whole lot of space companies, but obviously there are. So, are there launches that we're going to be able to see from Long Island in the next week? Maybe the answer is no. You probably said it already, but I was away from the rig for a little while. There are launches probably coming up this week that if you go to the right internet part, we can hear data about those launches. So run that by again, Paul. WS2N, KQIW.
Yeah, well, in the States, we don't have that many right now. It's just the SES 10, that's a Falcon 9 satellite. Falcon 9 is going to put that satellite into the geosynchronous orbit on the 29th, this coming Wednesday, from Florida. The Cygnus launch, they made a deal with the United Launch Alliance for another flight, be the fourth one, from Florida on an Atlas V rocket. And they'll have over 7,000 pounds of stuff going up. And that should be going up very shortly. I think they have a hydraulic leak. So I'm going to guess, I mean, it was scheduled for the 27th, but now I don't see that on the schedule. So my guess is probably sometime after that. I'll have to figure that one out. There are some foreign ones coming up, but like I said, the Ariane 5 was supposed to go up, but that didn't go up. So it's kind of like a break in the action. Yeah, India had some flights, and there's some flights scheduled for Japan coming up, but right now, I would just concentrate next Wednesday, or this coming Wednesday, on this SES 10 flight, and that's the one with the first reused booster, Falcon 9 booster from SpaceX back in there.
Sounds like a good one to look forward to. And I guess that's a Florida launch. What's the name of the website is your favorite to look up that launch, Paul?
I'll give you the exact one. Give me one second. There's a lot of them, but there's one that I use.
You begin.
QRZ, who was that? KQRIW.
I think it's Rich again, KTUPS. Georgia had like about $8 billion in space exports. I guess the technology, Pratt and Whitney, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, and Lockheed all have at least branches there.
Okay, Georgia is a busy place. And for all we know, they've got a very desirable state tax. Is that part of what attracts companies to go there? What's your guess, Rich?
Without a doubt, like UPS corporate headquarters for a while was up in Connecticut, and that was they were in. I'm trying to think the town they were in now. Stanford, maybe, but it was a little pricey for people down south or out west to come up there if they got a sign there. So now the headquarters is down in Atlanta. And I guess it's not as bad as going all the way down to Florida, but there's probably a lot of very attractive reasons for wanting to base it out of there.
Have you ever gone to the UPS headquarters in Atlanta or the one in Connecticut?
Nope, never had that chance yet.
So I guess in the modern day world with such a good internet traffic. You need not go to the headquarters anymore. Nowadays, you move signals, you don't move people. During the height of the B-1B program, where AIL was very heavily involved, the B-1B bomber, the hardware that was on board, 105 of those major boxes of the electronic system, AIL was supplying $250,000 per box, rough number. So something like $25 million worth of hardware was on each individual aircraft supplied by AIL. And we had a tremendous number of engineers flying every single week to California because an awful lot of the vendors for the subassemblies that went into the boxes, those subassembly vendors were in California. So a number of my fellow engineers were flying to California essentially every single week. They ran up tremendous numbers of frequent flyer miles. As I've told you guys a couple of times, let me drop a couple of my crazy engineering fellow people at AIL on a couple of occasions would fly out in the morning to California on the red eye or on a very early flight, attend a meeting at roughly noontime, and come back on the red eye that night. They would fly to California and come back home in roughly a 24-hour period, just for a few hours to go to a meeting there. Shipping human beings and not signals. My goodness, is that wasteful. Wow. To spend that much of your life in the air. How in the world did they tolerate that? Like I told you, on a couple of occasions, they held me at gunpoint and said, you're going to visit this vendor in California. I said, okay, I don't like to fly. I'm a white-knuckle flyer. You fly me to California. You're not going to see me again for more than a week. After I visit that vendor, I'm going to visit every microwave engineer, ham radio operator that I know in California. I don't care if he's in Los Angeles, San Diego, San Francisco. I'm going to visit every one of them. You're not going to see me for a week. I insisted on that. As such, the number of times they flew me out there probably went from 15 times per year down to twice per year. KTUPS, do you like flying, Rich? You'd much rather do surface transportation. KTUPS, K2IW.
Oh, I'm covering 5,000 miles every week, and it gets tough sometimes, but I am actually home 3 days a week, and it can get, what seems to me like only a day or two has transpired, is actually a whole week, so time seems accelerated while I'm working. But I don't mind flying, and I fly everywhere on vacation and stuff. I don't mind driving either, but flying doesn't scare me.
How long ago, Paul, if you want to, you don't have to answer this question. How long ago, because you put on so many miles per week, which is a very large amount of exposure time on the road, how long ago did somebody on the road do some kind of a very foolish driving maneuver behind, to the side, or in front of you while you were moving? How long ago did you have a nearly significant incident? KTUPS, K2LIW.
Hey, close calls happen every single time I'm behind the wheel. I was cut off earlier today. A guy came from the left lane around me and decided, oh, this is my exit. And instead of slowing down, getting behind me, getting off properly, he has to speed up, get in front of me, and then jam his brakes on because he had almost passed the exit at that point. So you really have to keep your eyes open, constantly checking where your mirror is, that you are as aware as you can be on the area surrounding the vehicle. And you just have to pay attention. It's almost a daily, multiple times a day that it's bad things can come real close to happening.
In the kind of driving you do, Rich, I am guessing you have to leave a very significant distance between you and the vehicle in front of you. to give you some alert time when something nasty happens. The good news is it gives you a lot more time to maneuver if the person in front of you 4 car lengths away, 5 car lengths away, does something foolish. The bad news is I'm guessing everybody wants to dive in front of you because they see that empty space. That's question number one. And question number two, when you get off the major highways and you get down to the more residential streets in order to get to your final destination, are there any red light cameras that you have to go through? KTUPS, KTRIW?
Well, I try to keep maybe a 7 to even 10 second distance between me and the vehicle in front of me on the interstate, but that can be difficult depending on the time of day, depending on the weather. Like right now, it's been raining for the last couple of hours, and pulling through trailers, I got axes on the ground. I'm kicking up a lot of spray, and I don't blame people that don't want to be behind me. But limited visibility, you know, they're going slow. I pass them, then they speed up, and then they keep getting in front of me because they don't want me in front of them. But instead of slowing me down, because I know I'm comfortable with what I'm doing, they should just back off and get further away, not drive 20 feet from my rear bumper so they can't see. As far as red light cameras, oh, sure. Many of the areas I go through, you get off the interstate, have cameras. And Manhattan gets, sometimes you get stuck in the middle, but, you know, you deal with it. Have any tickets ever come in? My boss hasn't mentioned any, but I'm sure if it was a problem, I'd be hearing about it.
When you are 2 tandem trailers, does that give you approximately 9 axles on the road, Rich? Go ahead, KTRIW.
KTUPS. It depends on the type of trailers that they are, whether they're pup trailers. Most of what I pull is pup trailers, and each trailer only has a single axle on it. And then there's a converter dolly that connects the two. So many times that usually only also has 1 axle on it. So if I'm pulling 2 trailers, I have 3 axles on the tractor, and then 3 between both trailers. However, they do pull doubles that are 48 or 53 foot. And both of those will have 2 axles on them, and the converted alleys for those can have 2 axles as well. So you have the capability of having between 6 and 9 axles pulling 2 trailers. And then, of course, triple goes 1 step further.
Therefore, in the worst case, the total number of tires that you're putting on the road is how many tires, Rich?
Like right now I got, 22. There's 22 are on the ground right now. 5 times 4 plus 2 steer axles, so 22 tires.
On a rainy day, I bet that kicks up a bit of mist. So if I was 5 car lengths behind you, my guess is I'm still getting a fierce amount of spray from your vehicle. I'd say 60 miles an hour. Is that true, Rich?
At 5 lengths back, you might still be getting a fair amount, but you back off a bit, and then it's not quite so bad. And most of our trailers also have, they kind of look like black mustaches, this little, about maybe 7 or 8 inch long, nylon, like a thin broom type of thing, nylon bristles, that are spaced on the side of the trailer, hanging down next to where the tires are, and those are supposed to be spray suppressors that help catch a lot of the moisture that the tire is throwing up, and hits that, makes it just drip right back down so it doesn't get tossed out to the side. That helps a little bit, but just give us room, that's all. But if the people are getting in front of me and trying to slow me down ridiculous speeds, when the speed limit is 65 miles an hour and they only want to do 40, then they don't belong on the interstate.
With all of those wheels you've got on the ground, when I try to pass you, if I'm in the very next lane, I'll bet I'm getting a lot of side spray. In other words, if this is the best of all worlds, you'd be in lane number one and I'd be crossing you in lane number 3. But if you're in lane number one and I've got to pass you in lane number 2, getting past you and still keeping visibility, under certain rainy conditions or snowy conditions, I'll bet that can be tough. Is that true, Rich? K2RIW?
Most definitely. And it's a very dangerous spot to be. And I don't care if it's a sunny, dry day or bad snow and heavy rain and fog. You do not want to drive and stay next to a truck. Get in front of him. Get behind him. Don't stay next to him. Because particularly in bad weather, you're in the worst of the spray from the tires, so your visibility is poor. But if there's something in front of me that happens, and I, you know, to avoid rear-ending somebody in front of me, or maybe I have a tire blowout, the truck jerks to the left or something and runs into you, you just don't want to be there. But so many people do that, and it makes no sense.
There's a number of occasions in my four-wheeler where I probably didn't have enough seconds of spacing between me and the vehicle in front of me. And the vehicle in front of me did something unexpected very rapidly. And had I done nothing but locked up all four, I would have hit him. So on a number of cases, I've had to steer around the vehicle in front of me. I'll bet there's a few times when you maybe have had to do that. Is that true, Paul? Rich, KTUPS, K2RIW.
KTUPS. Well, the space in front of the vehicle is the one area that the driver has the most control over. You can't really control who's behind you or to your side, but you can control how much space you have directly in front of you. So there's really no reason why you should ever have a front-end collision. But, of course, we all know other people do crazy things. They cut you off and jam on the brakes, or maybe they have engine or tire blowouts and end up in front of you, or a deer runs out of the woods right in front of you. And you try to stop in time if you can, but jerking the wheel one way or the other, when you pull, especially pulling multiple trailers, you're just looking to jackknife and then lose traction and cause a major problem. So, I mean, when traffic starts getting heavy, you got to slow down and, again, be ready for everything. When you see something crazy, always expect people to do what you least want them to do, because many times that's what they're going to do.
Okay, we've used up our time. This was TechNet number 1,644. Amazing number. 34, let me think now. 82. Yeah, 34 and a fraction years worth of TechNet. Space report number 244. 73, you all. Paul and I intend to be back next week. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. And look out for those vehicles on the road. Over to you, Paul, for any final. WS2N. Thank you. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, real good. And if you want to find a good line schedule, spaceflightnow.com. That will give you a lot of information about what's going on. But if you go to the same website and you just put at the end of it /launch-schedule, you'll get the actual schedule of worldwide flights. So it's spaceflightnow.com/launch-schedule. We'll be back next week. I'm looking at the time. 73 guys, Rich, safe driving. And we'll be back next week. Back to you, Dick, if you want to take it. This is WS2N.
Thank you for that URL. Sounds good. Bye-bye for now.
73 gang. Good net as always. TCUPS.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Next tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Next tonight at 8:30, W2VL Repeater System. Next tonight at 8:30, welcome to the W2VL Repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Next tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
N2EO, N2EO and 2MV. N2EO and 2MB.
Does anybody get up this early?
Don't have the bleeper on yet. Good morning. Yes, of course. I'm getting ready to leave. I've been up for a half an hour already. What are you doing up? You heard my rooster, right?
Sure did. Is that a recording? I can't believe you've got a real rooster in the house, although it's possible.
Not around here. It's my wristwatch. It tells me every morning at 5 o'clock I got to get up and get out of here.
So that's the alarm on your wristwatch. That's a lot of sound out of a wristwatch.
It really is. It's amazing. This little thing, it's amazing. It really is. I don't know how they get so much sound out of it. I really don't.
What brand name is that watch? And is the loudspeaker against your wrist?
Yeah, but it's Chinese. My wife bought it. I don't know what brand it is. I have no idea.
You chose rooster sound as the alarm. Are there other potential sounds you can choose?
About 10 of them. Some kind of music. A whole bunch of different sounds, yeah. They're cute.
Are any of the other sounds animals?
No. That's the only animal. That's the only animal. All the other ones are weird. They're cute, but, you know, I like the rooster. It's kind of synonymous with getting up in the morning.
You know, a rooster is an animal.
Yes, yes. I'm wholly and fully aware of this thing. There used to be a guy in this neighborhood that had a rooster. And the rooster did make noise at around sunup. I don't know why they do that, but we had it for years, and I guess one day they ate the rooster. I don't know. I don't hear it anymore.
Repeater, time out.
How close are you to Brooklyn? You're actually in Queens, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm pretty far from Brooklyn. The nearest point of Brooklyn would be over the bridge, which I guess would be about road miles as the crow flies, let's put it that way, with a rooster. I guess it's about 8 miles as the crow flies.
8 miles due west, right on your island?
Yeah, northwest.
Well, all of Long Island slants up to the northeast and southwest. So doesn't your peninsula do something very similar?
No. This is Queens. We're in Queens. And Queens, I don't know, it's kind of an odd arrangement. I got to look at a map, but this was made part of Queens about 60 years ago. It used to be part of Long Island.
Geographically, Queens and Kings are Long Island. But the modern-day person says, hey, those are the five boroughs of New York City. That's not Long Island.
Yeah, well, guess what I gotta do? Otherwise, I'll be late to get my wife. I gotta go. So I might talk to you from the car. If I don't have a big surprise when I get out there, which is not uncommon. Good morning, by the way.
Big surprise of what? A rooster sitting on your car?
Yeah, well, my car not working or starting up or something. So, I gotta go. I'll talk to you from my car in about 10 minutes. This was N2MB.
Later, dude.
Okay, dude.
There are recent articles being written, Barry, saying that the food pyramid was wrong and all of our avoidance of fats was wrong, and that a diabetic person really should be eating more fat and less and even less fructose and things like that. Things are changing. I wonder if you read any of those recent articles on this, Jazz. K2RAW.
No B. Yeah, it reminds me of a joke. It was a skit, I think, on TV where they came back 1,000 years later, and exactly what people were doing, eating all the wrong things, and it was good for them. You know what? I'm going to give that a little time. I find diabetics... diabetic, she should eat less, a lot less. That's really good. It doesn't matter what you eat, just eat a lot less of it.
Yeah, that's got to be true. More exercise, a lot of it, a lot less of it. That was a Woody Allen movie. I think it was called Bananas, where he comes back in the 23rd century. And all the so-called junk food is now known to be good stuff.
Yeah, I'm waiting.
But, yeah, there's some somewhat authoritative sounding articles saying fat is a lot safer for a diabetic person to eat than carbohydrates.
Yeah. I, as you can tell, I don't study it. I live it, but I don't study it. I do avoid sugar. That's because I have diabetes. Doesn't give you diabetes, but because I have it.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Don't worry, I heard everything on the input. What people have done, particularly some of my friends, for years on end, 2, 3, 4, 5 bottles of Pepsi Cola or Coca Cola in a day, the amount of sugar that's in that beverage is just out of sight.
But I don't believe the sugar gives you diabetes. There are some people that will never buy it. I believe... shut up. I believe that if you're diabetic, you're in trouble. And I also think that diabetics should eat a lot less. You notice... Well, it depends. Hold a second. I don't think the timer's working. I think that diabetics should eat much less. I've noticed that 99% of diabetics have a fat belly. And I believe that's a serious thing. I think that means something, and they should pay attention to it. I don't know. I think that fat deposit in that part of your body is perhaps dangerous. That's what I'm thinking. I don't have a fat belly. I have very few symptoms of diabetes. Richie Tashner tells me I'm so lucky I don't have a bad case. You know, just about everybody on my mother's side of the family is dead because of diabetes. So I think I have a bad case. I think I would be as sick as everybody else, but I think I'm doing the right thing. I think vigorous exercise burns sugar, burns everything. Burns fat, burns sugar. Being thin... Your body doesn't store the stuff in your fat. I think these are the marks of danger, but nobody else agrees with me. You know what? I'm going to be the last man.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Do you believe you are a type 1 or a type 2? And at what age do you believe you had the onset? And what were the first symptoms?
Okay, I believe I'm a type 2, definitely. Type 1, all the rules have changed. I know people that are type 1 and it's not the same thing, and all the things I just told you make no sense. A lot of type 1s are thin and have very little body fat. I don't know if they exercise or not.